Your call cannot be completed as dialed. The number you have reached has been disconnected or is no longer in service. Please check the number and try your call again, or contact the operator for further assistance.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm busy. I forgot we were on the air until about 5 minutes ago. No, actually, a little before then, but not too much before then. It's crazy. So much going on. We also have out in Signal Land, we have, what is that, Rob T. Firefly?
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Hello.
And it looks like we have Alex.
You do indeed. Good evening.
Okay. It also looks like we have one channel, Kyle. Can you come over and look at this this level here? I'm not sure on the thing I'm pointing to,
right.
the thing you're doing. We're having some connectivity issues right there. Okay, now it's fixed because you touched something, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks better now.
All right, good. Sorry, folks, high-tech solutions to
as you're saying,
low-tech problems. Anyone have anything interesting they'd like to catch up with? Some things involving the hacker world, technology? Come on, you live lives. Tell us what's going on.
We do live lives. There is actually one thing that we got an email about from a listener. A listener has emailed us letting us know that the first annual PhoneCon is going to be held July 25th to 26th at the Computer Museum at System Source in Hunt Valley, Maryland. And so that's this weekend coming up, Saturday and Sunday. It's the 150th anniversary of the invention of the telephone. And our listener writes, it's long past due that an annual conference be held for telephone collectors, telecom and data professionals, hackers, phone freaks, and telephone enthusiasts of all kinds. And you can get all your info about this at phonecon.org. That's phonecon.org.
So where is this happening?
This is happening at the Computer Museum at System Source in Hunt Valley, Maryland. And it looks like an interesting place, and it's on its own. And the perfect place to be holding something like this.
Wow! So it's the 150th anniversary of the phone, and that would my math is not up to par. What does that put it? Back in the 1800s, obviously, but when?
1876.
1876. Yeah. Okay, that sounds familiar. So
spirit.
Why aren't things going on all throughout the world to herald this event? 150 years of the telephone.
That's an excellent question.
I mean, I think it's probably eclipsed by the 250th anniversary of, I guess, what can be considered the oldest constitutional democracy.
Oh, you're kidding. You're serious. Okay, fine.
Well, I do think it's eclipsed. Yeah.
I think most people are just trying to forget the embarrassment that this country has turned into. But whatever. So 150 years of the phone. Unfortunately, not too many people are using phones. At least not like they used to. I just had a landline-to-landline conversation with a friend of mine, and it was really cool. Of course, we're not using copper. We're using, voice over IP and all that nonsense. But it's better than using a cell phone and not being able to understand half the things that are being said or be able to hear the background noise.
Absolutely. There's something to be said for, talking down a wire at somebody. And we get so few opportunities to do such things nowadays.
Okay. So small talk out of the way. Let's look at some news items. By the way, we have Overtime coming on again tonight at 8 o'clock on YouTube, channel 2600. That's how you find us over there. You probably heard this story out of New Jersey. I'm quoting from the New York Times here. Roughly 400 non-citizens cast ballots in New Jersey after about 6,600 residents were improperly registered to vote between June 2023 and June 2024 because of a software error at the Motor Vehicle Commission. That's according to Governor Mikie Schorell. She announced this yesterday. All the people affected had disclosed that they were not citizens when seeking either a driver's license or an ID, and they were registered anyway. Okay, so everything that Trump was saying is true, right? And that's what we're supposed to get at. I mean, that's the Fox News version of this. So these people come and they say, we are not citizens, and they are forced to vote. I'm trying to process this. Basically, okay, the message is that if there is a software error, anything is possible. And I guess 6,000 people being registered to vote when they're not eligible to vote, that is possible with bad software, with somebody not doing their job. What's remarkable about this is that very few people comparatively actually used this access they were given improperly. I'm not sure what told the 400 non-citizens to vote. Maybe they were getting reminders in the mail or something. It strikes me as odd that 400 people would just say, hey, you know what, I'm going to try to vote, and hey, look at this, I was able to vote. I don't think it was nefarious like that. I think people were misled. And the other thing to remember here is that this was caught. It took a while, but they caught it. And not only did they catch it, they revealed it. They didn't try to hide it. So there are a few things here that are quite interesting. But one thing that this was not was a plot by immigration activists or whatnot to get people from other countries to vote in our elections. It seems like incompetence once again wins. I don't know, Alex, what are your thoughts?
This is a fascinating story, like most of the stories that we cover that have to deal with sort of idiotic bugs and divisions of responsibilities here. But I think this is pretty simple to realize what happened, right? You go to register for whatever you're doing at Motor Vehicles. Motor Vehicles is basically a great place to register people to vote as well when they're getting licenses, renewing licenses, et cetera, updating the voter rolls. It makes perfect sense. So the software ask somebody if they were a citizen. If they were a citizen, then it's supposed to go on some kind of path that registers them to vote. If you register as no, I'm sorry if there's something going on in the background here. If you say no, that's supposed to be a condition that the software enforces and then pushes you down a different flow. And obviously that didn't happen. Obviously there was a problem between the yes and no answers here. And if you answered no, there was no condition that was enforced and you were still registered over to vote. So then here's where the division of responsibilities becomes an issue to my mind, because That's certainly on the software developer. Whoever developed the software should have tested the logic and done some kind of quality assurance or auditing to make sure that the data flowed in the right ways. And it wasn't flowing in the right ways, especially on these really important questions. So you could argue that that they had a duty to do this, they breached it, and that caused this issue. So this was some form of negligence. But also, what about the government people themselves? What about the Department of State where the voter rolls are actually held? They should have some measure of responsibility, or measure. Maybe there should have been a division of labor between these two systems, such that the Department of State performed some kind of double check to make sure. But I don't know really where or how they would have checked the citizenship of individual people, and in this respect as well. So I find this story to be one of kind of almost like a comedy of errors here, things that should have been caught extremely easily and have no real downstream effect. I want to pass it over to you guys as well, because I could keep talking about this for another 5 or 10 minutes and have some ways to connect it to some other stories that we had discussed over the last few weeks. So I'm going to pass it over to Rob.
That would be nice. Also, any chance that you could be in a different room than the dog? That would be really, really nice. Go ahead, Rob.
She's going crazy. I apologize.
I mean, personally, I agree with the dog. But the interesting thing about this story is I don't think they've given out details as to actually what went wrong. And do we know for sure that it was the software itself glitching rather than the sort of software error where a person uses the software incorrectly? You know, someone sleepy at a keyboard types Tuttle instead of Buttle, and all sorts of shenanigans can go down. And so the technology company, which is called Idemia, which sounds like a disease, is saying that it's ultimately the responsibility of the state's Division of Elections to verify all the information transmitted, including the residents' eligibility to vote. So they're passing the blame back to the Board of Elections, and the Board of Elections seem to be pushing it onto the vendor. So for us to really be able to tell more about what happened here, I think would be of great value in this case.
Yeah, the name of the company is Idemia, I-D-E-M-I-A. They're based in Virginia. They have offices all around the world. And they said the state's Division of Elections was ultimately responsible for verifying all information transmitted, including residents' eligibility to vote. And that's not how the state sees it. They believe that the software vendor was responsible for the error, and that they were being phased out of use in New Jersey. The mistake was discovered back in 2024 while Philip Murphy was governor, but it was never publicly disclosed. When asked for comment, Mr. Murphy, the former governor, did not reply for emails, calls, or a text message. Yeah, it's not responsive to this at all. Ms. Sherrill was unstinting in her criticism of the way the Murphy administration handled the problem, citing reckless failures. It's unacceptable that the vendor released software with such a glaring error. It's unacceptable that the MVC took a year to get this issue fixed. And it's unacceptable that no one in the previous administration brought this to light, demanded accountability, or took action when it happened years ago. The finding that roughly 400 non-citizens had cast ballots in New Jersey is one of the largest confirmed instances of non-citizens voting in American elections, but it remains an exceptionally small percentage of the overall vote total. And it seems more like incompetence and misinformation than malice, at least at this particular stage. If those 400 non-citizens had all voted in the state's local elections in 2023, they would constitute just 0.02% of the electorate. If they voted in the 2024 presidential election, those 400 non-citizens would make up about 0.009% of the state's overall vote totals. So, yeah, it's a tiny number, but it is something quite important, because this is what it's all about: who is eligible to vote, who is not eligible to vote, and the White House is seizing upon this. Democrats and their media allies have repeatedly said it is impossible for non-citizens to register to vote, let alone cast a ballot, said White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson. American voters deserve to have confidence that our elections are safe and secure. Okay, but Abigail, here's the thing. You know, if somebody just basically fills out a form and fills it out wrong, and they have the authority to file that form as an official document, what do you do? How do you prevent that? It's incompetence. It's incompetence. It's been revealed. It's being dealt with. I'm not sure how the Save America Act would have prevented any of this. It's it makes no sense to me. Alex, go ahead.
I think, you know, they're totally wrong in that assumption. I think there are other ways to connect this to other Trump initiatives. But to stick on that point for just a moment, it's so clear that the non-citizens who accidentally gained the right to vote through somebody else's error had no intention of gaining the right to vote. And I thought you brought up a really excellent point. It's a rare thing that when it happens, Emmanuel, but, you know, you got to call it out when it does. And, did these people receive any literature in the mail basically suggesting that they vote or even just, you know, operating under the assumption that they are registered to vote and therefore eligible to vote? And that's why these people voted. I mean, and the voter rolls are, of course, very often used for these types of political mailings. So I wouldn't be surprised at all. In fact, I'd probably be surprised if they didn't receive literature in the mail suggesting that they go out and vote. So whose fault is that? But I think there's a better way to connect this, though, to some Trump administration initiatives, because what this story reminded me of is what we were discussing last week or the week before. And it's that you know, this reminder that government software and civic software, it's not just like one app that works seamlessly, right? There's this whole stack of interdependent, essentially failures, just waiting for one bad assumption to be made about a logic gate. And this is why this whole idea of the National Design Studio that we were talking about last week or the week before is so totally insane. This National Design Studio that Trump wants to redesign everything in some kind of sleek, modern, you know, new HTML, CSS style sheet or whatever the hell it is at this point for all of the .gov top-level domain. It just shows you why that's a total disaster waiting for somebody to do something just like this, right? You are just essentially redecorating a disaster waiting to happen.
Go ahead, Gayla.
I think the other thing that I was thinking of, and Alex, absolutely, it's not like these 400 people, you know, with malice aforethought attempted to register to vote, because I think that's what they're trying to say is the SAVE Act, right? That marauding non-citizens are trying to vote and throw all our elections. Come on. But IDEMIA, I knew I'd heard of them before. Apparently, they're a massive multinational biometrics organization. And I interacted with their products last week because I was flying and I have TSA PreCheck. And IDEMIA runs the company that runs the facial recognition for TSA PreCheck. They own and operate all of the little kiosks that are in every Staples where you can go get your TSA PreCheck interview. So as much as it also is that, you know, all of these multitude of entities are all kind of relying on each other and we have all these dominoes lined up in terms of websites and responsibilities and this and that and the other, but there's also a very small number of organizations that are kind of concentrated in these areas doing a lot of pretty important stuff. And yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you'll find them, I guess, in a lot of places. The point is, though, you know, incompetence, bad software, that trumps everything. You know, you'll be able to just get past any barriers if that exists. You know, there's just no getting around that. You know, you can say that, yes, you require an original birth certificate to be able to get permission to vote. But then if somebody just says, okay, you gave that to me, check, and you're in, how do you prevent that? You don't. You know, this is what we're looking at here. People that were given the wrong status, through no fault of their own. And here's the thing. There is a real concern about what's going to happen, especially to the 400 people who mistakenly cast ballots. And, you know, think about what you get in the mail before an election. You get a postcard tells you where your polling place is. You probably get all kinds of election pamphlets and things. So people naturally thought, oh, I guess I qualify. You know, they're not up on common rules and current events and all that kind of thing. So they can be forgiven for thinking the wrong thing because they were told the wrong thing. But now there is a real concern that they are going to be prosecuted by the federal government. And the governor of New Jersey said she's afraid those people might now be at risk of not only federal prosecution, but all kinds of unexpected hurdles through no fault of their own as they work towards becoming citizens. She said, we're working very hard to protect them. But think about it. How do you protect them? You know, the voter polls, the voter registration list, that's public. They can find out who those people were. They can target those people. And we know this administration will do things like that. They don't care if the people are innocent. They will go after them. So I'm more concerned about that than anything else here that is an error that's been fixed. It's just the horrible way that individuals are treated. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, the collateral consequences of this are something I didn't consider for these non-citizens, and it is absolutely true, especially if they are facing some kind of federal charge for voter fraud. You know, what Gila and I were both banging on about before is this issue of intent. And under federal law, you can't have any kind of punishment for somebody who knowingly votes. I'm sorry, you would actually have to have somebody who knowingly votes when they know they are not eligible. That's the kind of, it's kind of like a double knowledge requirement there. So you have to know you're not eligible and knowingly vote at that time, right? That's the only way that you could satisfy the criminal elements of a particular charge for voting in that manner. So you would have to have the intentionality there. But to be honest with you, that doesn't matter. Whether or not somebody is convicted of a particular crime doesn't matter. If you're charged with a crime, if you are an immigrant, non-citizen, even if you have an asylum claim pending, and you are simply charged with a crime, it could be disorderly conduct, it could be shoplifting, could be any number of things, that usually is necessary and sufficient condition for an immigration judge to deny you bond if ICE picks you up, because you might be considered to be a danger to the community or a flight risk to the community. In fact, the latest case that we were talking about last week that I won, my sixth petition for writ of habeas corpus on behalf of an ICE detainee, this was a person who was detained for almost 3 months, 2.5 months, for a bogus shoplifting charge. It was basically a petty larceny charge, and it wasn't a conviction. It wasn't anything proven. In fact, it was trying to be plea bargained down, but because of something called the Lake and Riley Act, and we all know the tragedy that happened with Lake and Riley, and it's not making light of that, but the act that followed this to try to protect people from violent non-citizens roaming around our streets basically made it a predicate to be charged with any of these enumerated offenses. Was a predicate that was sufficient enough for somebody to just be held in ICE detention. And so this is, I think, a really dangerous position for a lot of these non-citizens to find themselves in, and really sad that it's done by no fault of their own. If somebody knew that they weren't supposed to vote and they voted, that's still against the law. But we're talking about what I would presume is the vast majority of situations for these 400 people are that they were encouraged to vote and they went out and voted because they probably felt like it was their civic duty, being reminded over and over and over again by massive amounts of campaign advertisements. So if there's collateral consequences here, I'll be the first one to jump up and try to help them out of this mess.
Yeah, the other thing that kind of gets me here is the assumption that this kind of mistake only benefits one side. It could benefit anyone if people vote and they aren't entitled to vote. You don't know who they're going to vote for. Are people that aren't legally permitted to vote all Democrats? Is that the view here? Apparently it is, because that's how they keep pushing things like the Save America Act, which, by the way, is one of the greatest threats to democracy that I could imagine. It basically takes the control of elections out of the hands of local authorities and puts it in the hands of federal authorities. Your driver's license will not be enough to prove who you are. You'll need to get access to birth certificates and all kinds of documents that a lot of people don't have access to. And all of this information is going to be kept in centralized databases like they have never been done before. It's truly a scary thing, and they are using fear to try and get people to support this. And we've seen so many congressmen basically pushing lies and stoking fear to get people to back this, which would be an incredibly bad idea, bad for democracy, bad for all of us. Go ahead, Rob.
And it's worth noting that in this particular case, these roughly 400 non-citizens who were miscategorized as having the right to vote, if all of them voted in the election, this is pointed out in this article in the Times, if all of them had voted, they would constitute just 0.02% of the electorate. They would not have swayed any of the elections in 2024 when Harris actually, in the presidential election, won New Jersey by more than 252,000 votes. So even if all of these people voted, and there's no indication that they did, even if they all voted on the same side, which there's no indication that they did, it would not have changed anything substantial in terms of the election itself. So this is a rounding error, basically, mathematically speaking. So there is no actual threat to the end result of the election in this case.
Yeah, there's no question it shouldn't have happened, but it was caught and it was revealed and it's being dealt with. And that's something that we should be praising, not using as evidence to make things even worse. Alex?
Well, On that very note, right? We're talking about the legal exposure, jeopardy these people could be facing of these 400 people who actually did the right thing, right? And I think that would certainly counsel me if I was a prosecutor thinking about bringing a charge, saying, "Well, did this person do the right thing?" I mean, they answered no, they were not a citizen, and then accidentally registered to vote by somebody else, right? It's like, so it's a terrible thing, but. What about the other side of this, right? Why are we not talking about any kind of legal exposure for people who knowingly withheld this information or the people who negligently created these systems? I mean, I think those are the ones that should really be concerned about the maximum amount of liability here. And I'm talking really about civil liability here because, as Rob noted, this was de minimis. And there is this old expression in the law, it's Latin, of course, de minimis non curat lex, right? The law doesn't care about trifles. And to me, this is certainly a trifle, but it exposes some really bad systems. And I think you're right. It is a rare thing when you write twice in a row in like 5 minutes, Emmanuel. It's amazing to me. But that's what we should be applauding here.
Talking of liability too, Idemia, looking at their own Wikipedia article, there's a lot to learn here. They're a French company and they have fingers and pies all over the world, and they are no strangers to being liable for things. There is an extensive controversies section on this article with headings like sharing sensitive biometric data, bribery in Nigeria, hiding Russian government affiliated code from the FBI in a product that they used in fingerprint analysis software, contained code written by a Russian government affiliated firm, and they hid that fact from the FBI, contributions to state repression in Egypt, all sorts of other things in addition to this thing in Jersey. So they are no strangers to basically being called out on stuff. But, you know, will they be held liable for this error in any substantial way remains to be seen.
Human error always conquers all. And I think that's just another indication of why we need to be checking things and never believe anything that you're told. Now, on that note, Trump's Mad King speech was last Thursday. You guys catch this? I mean, you know, a lot of networks didn't cover it. And I think that was kind of a mistake because, you know, if you have King Lear, you know, falling apart, the people should know. The people should see it. The people should witness it and plan accordingly. You know, not just ignore it and pretend everything's okay, because that's kind of playing into it. What he says is going to affect us, and what he said on Thursday certainly is going to affect us. This is where he basically laid it out for us as far as how elections are going to be run in the immediate future, if he has any say over it, claiming that basically everything is vulnerable to being hacked, and this is where we come in, obviously. Now, I should point out there's no evidence that foreign or domestic hackers have ever exploited electronic voting machines to change votes or impact the outcome of an election. Now, investigators did find that Russian hackers successfully accessed the voter registration databases of a few U.S. states ahead of the 2016 elections, but they never changed any votes. And to date, that's the most intensive hacking effort documented by federal authorities involving U.S. elections. The way Trump is playing it, it's basically it's a free-for-all. And everybody, especially Democrats, are out there hacking voting machines and stealing votes. Basically, just spreading lies. I think at one point he said that there was a machine where you pressed a button for Trump and it came out Biden. You know, just making it up. So many instances like that, but people believe it. And Fox News parrots it. It's scary because we're facing an election in a few months that is going to change the direction of the country. And these guys know they're going to lose. They're going to lose badly unless they do something dramatic. And that is what we are seeing. I don't want to say in its infancy because it's well developed. We're going to see a lot more speeches like last Thursday's. We're going to see a lot more scare tactics. And I hope we're prepared for this.
Well, the important thing is to have a ground game and respond to it so that you're identifying these things immediately countering it with the appropriate correct information and awareness about the tools and the types of tactics that are being used. But it's absolutely the way that the machine of our democracy renews and replaces some of these problems, shall we say. And if we don't get to do that, then we are in even worse trouble than we are, looking at that election as a possible moment to register and figure out what people are for and what they are not with about this whole thing.
Whoever is typing, please stop because it's very loud. So did you all see the documents that were released last Thursday? Because they're quite interesting. Any of us look at them? Guys, you got to take an interest in this. I mean, we're, at the forefront here. It's
I look at a lot of documents, but what documents? What are you talking
these
about?
Are documents released by the White House saying that they prove that the elections are being compromised, that hackers are running amok. You know, it's kind of up our alley. But according to this Political article, documents released by the White House this Thursday did not back up Trump's claims of widespread exploitation of electronic voting machines. One 2020 report from the National Intelligence Council detailed concerns that foreign hackers might seek to compromise U.S. election infrastructure, but did not conclude this occurred. Just expressed concern that this could happen. But, no actual evidence. Scott Alger, Executive Director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center, said, "I'm not aware of an incident in which a vote has been changed through a hack. There's lots of opportunity for that to happen because we have lots of elections. And I think the fact that it hasn't happened is an indication of how secure the overall election process is." But that, of course, was not mentioned in the speech or in the remarks by the White House afterwards. Go ahead, Gila.
So, Emmanuel, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So this is a great big lie. This is a big fat lie. And there are no documents to back up the big fat lie.
Well, there's basically, yes, you have the gist of it.
Okay, just making sure. I just, kind of trying to are we supposed to be surprised that there are no documents that support the big fat lie?
You're still supposed to be scared. I feel that you're not being scared enough.
You're probably right. But No, I mean, obviously the documents didn't support it because it's a big fat lie.
Well, I think we've made the point. I do. Yes, go ahead, Alex.
You know, this is, I feel like, exactly the same conversation we were having exactly 10 years ago and talking about the election, right? And you also bring up this point, Emmanuel, that, yes, the voter rolls, you know, this is being accessed by a Russian threat actor, ostensibly by the GRU, as I believe it is supposed to be. That seems to be the most serious incident to date of anything that's actually been reported here. And if that were to happen back in 2016, who do you think the Russians would have favored at that particular moment, number one? But I think that we have evolved as a nation in many ways with respect to our voting systems. This is something that our dear friend of our show, Matt Blaze, does a tremendous amount of research on down at Georgetown. But, you know, the security of election systems, the fact that they are so many disparate systems that run independently across the country, that's something, and I do hate this phrase, but I will use it, you know, that's kind of a feature, not a bug, right? You know, the fact that they are all disconnected and different makes it difficult for any one threat actor to infiltrate the entire nation's voting systems. But even if they did, what we've moved on to over the last 10 years, because of, in large part, I think, the cries of the hacker and the cybersecurity community about vulnerabilities inherent to direct recording electronic voting, which means votes that are cast purely electronically on a ballot without any kind of paper trail associated with a vote. We've moved away from that. I don't know if there are any jurisdictions where that still exists just by itself. I imagine probably a few. It's got to be extraordinarily rare, though, at this point. And every time you go and vote, you fill out something on a piece of paper. That piece of paper is then scanned. The results are then transcribed into some kind of database of votes, right, and a tally. And so this voter-verified paper ballot or this paper record, it's a very interesting, you know, aspect of election security, right? Because it doesn't make elections unbreachable or unhackable in some sense. It just makes sure that if you are going to tamper with an election in some way, that there's evidence of it and you can track and trace it and you can audit that type of thing when it happens. So I think Trump is totally wrong and way behind the times here. I know that's shocking to a lot of people.
All right, let's move on. Rob, you posted this story. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit about LG, the home appliance giant. LG Electronics USA said this week it plans to suspend any apps built for its smart TVs that turn one's television into an always-on residential proxy node. The move comes less than a month after researchers found more than 42% of games and other apps available for download on LG's webOS store allow unknown third parties to route their internet traffic through a user's TV. Okay, these are some things I'm not really familiar with. Can you describe this universe that we're looking upon right now?
Sure thing. So LG has their app store for apps you can download and install on your television, because televisions are computers now, and this is the world we live in. And apparently, so many of the apps in this app store were basically, in addition to whatever it was they were supposed to be doing, were also using the user's television as a proxy. So they could sell access to your television, to your television's connection, to whatever else is going on it, to various third parties, with or without your knowledge. Some of these apps would have little screens that gave you choices. There is, and this is heartbreaking to me, there was a Pac-Man app for LG TV, and I love Pac-Man. Who doesn't love Pac-Man? But it gave you a choice to either play the game by watching ads, which is gross, or decline and instead give the app company permission to use your TV as a residential proxy node. This is insane that so much of the base of applications on this app store were basically using your TV as a jumping off point to do God knows what with your connection with that computer that's shaped like a television on your shelf. And the end result of this is that people have been complaining about this, and LG is finally realizing that they run an app store and they should perhaps maybe have some kind of overseeing of the security and the abuse of such things on it. So they're removing a bunch of apps.
So, you know, it wasn't until this moment that I realized this is good news.
It is good news that it's being addressed. It is horrid news that this was going on, but it's the technological environment we're living in now. It's stupid as hell, and I can't believe this is a thing. But at the same time, I totally can believe that this is something that unscrupulous companies would be taking advantage of. I just can't believe they're using my boy Pac-Man to do it.
Go ahead, Alex.
this is a really crazy story. And I think Rob hit it right on the head too. You know, in that the real outrage here is that this has been happening for so long. But you know, think about this, right? This is basically other people using your IP address and your home network through your television to do God knows what. This could have been really, really bad. And maybe, who knows? Maybe this has been really, really bad for some people. Because what if that connection? What if the proxy relay that your television was used for was to distribute child pornography or child sexual abuse material?
Why is it always child pornography? Why is that always?
I'll tell you why. Because it's a strict liability offense. And if you're transiting in child pornography, or if it goes across your network in that particular situation, I mean, I wonder if there are people who have been criminally prosecuted for the possession of CSAM materials or child pornography when it was simply being relayed across their network. And let's also not forget that, you know, this is a great reason to enforce something called device isolation on your router, which means that certain devices shouldn't be able to see or talk to other devices on the network, when usually, you know, we think, oh, it's a good thing for devices to talk together, because your television is sitting there basically smack in the middle of your network. You want everything to be able to see it, because you might want to stream things to it, right? So it's not isolated from the rest of the house. It could be a foothold near your router. You could perhaps access printers through that. You could perhaps access network attached storage, individual machines that might have SSH enabled in them as well. So, you know, untold amounts of craziness could have happened through the malicious use of these, what I think are, and Rob, am I right in thinking it's like a web OS type of app store? Is that what this ridiculous thing was?
I don't know the exact OS these things are using, but I can't imagine it's very different from a web OS store, or even the Android store, or iTunes store, or whatever they're calling it now. It's just, you know, it's a closed app store. You can download sort of a selection of apps that are put there with the tacit approval of the company running the thing. And there is some responsibility in running something like that, that you're not going to be feeding your customers crap on this level. So, yeah, and this article, which was on Krebs on Security, and I want to shout them out for putting this out there, it really opens people's eyes to a fact that any hacker will tell you, which is that once you're in a network by any means, it's pretty easy to, you know, getting in is the hard part. It's pretty easy once you're in there to do whatever you want with anything connected to it, you know, more or less. So this is not only, you know, they're abusing my television. This is, you're letting people into what might potentially be every aspect of everything that's on your home network and every aspect of your digital life.
Wasn't there another company several years back that just offered your router, your bandwidth to anybody passing by in the street, and they treated it like it was the most normal thing in the world? I don't remember who that was, but it was it might have been a cable provider, it might have been some other merchant or something that had a lot of access to customers. Anybody remember that?
I'm looking.
I do remember this. I think it might have been Spectrum doing that, where your router would also be part of Spectrum's own network to give to their customers. I don't know for certain that it was Spectrum, but it was either them or some provider on the scale of them. Uh-huh. And it's amazing to think about it.
I like the assumptions they make that, oh, yeah, people will be good with this. No, no problem at all. When's the last time they hung out with people? What in God's name is going on out there?
Alex, that's from wherever you are. There was some sort of motory noise.
I was afraid that was the music
starting.
About
that. Yeah.
Okay, you have to explain that. That wasn't the dog. What was that? Sounded like a spaceship.
That was some kind of car that needed a new muffler, I think. It sounded like it was very far away. I don't really understand that.
No, it didn't. It sounded pretty damn close.
These are just good mics. I apologize.
Are you in Pennsylvania?
I am in Pennsylvania at the moment.
Well, that explains that.
This is why.
Right.
Yep, you got it. Yep.
Okay. Hey, listen, before we run out of time, I just wanted to remind people WBAI is in the middle of a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. And if you want to keep discussions like this coming, or maybe the discussions that come after this one is over and you say good riddance, please support WBAI. We've been on the air since 1960 and have yet to air a commercial because we don't believe in them. We don't need them. We don't want them. We need investors in the form of listeners, and that's what we have had ever since 1960. And we have been able to stay on the air in the middle of New York City for all that time and build up an incredibly devoted following all kinds of archives and history and memories that WBAI is unique with. If you look at any other radio station in New York City, you will find that WBAI is if not the oldest, one of the oldest by far, as far as keeping the same basic format, which is a free form format, meaning we have many formats. We have music, we have talk, we have news, all sorts of different things throughout the course of a day. We need your help to keep that going because we have to pay the bills somehow and we're not getting money through commercials. And this current federal government sure isn't helping at all. So please go to WBAI.org or give to WBAI.org. There's a number of websites. Does anybody have the full listing or numbers or anything else you could share?
Yep. We've got the phone number for pledging to the station. That's 833-922-4692. That also spells 833-WBAI-NYC, which is very handy. Or you could go to buddy.wbai.org to give a one-time donation or become a sustaining BAI Buddy member, which is something that helps us so very much, where you agree to automatically give a certain amount, an amount of your choosing on a regular basis. So that's buddy.wbai.org or 833-WBAI-NYC.
And regardless of whether you call or whether you go online or, I don't know, you put some cash in an envelope and mail it to the station, do let them know that you are supporting Off the Hook because they like to know that you like us. So tell them we sent you.
Yes, please. Support WBAI. Keep us going. Keep 99.5 FM commercial free and alternative and interesting because so much on the radio isn't interesting anymore. It's predictable. It's pre-programmed. It's computerized. It's boring. Just boring. Okay, so we only have a couple of minutes left. All right, what story shall we get to really quickly? Well, here's an interesting headline. Hackers are stealing data they can't even read yet because they're banking on quantum computers to crack it later. You know, that's smart. That is smart. You might not be able to decrypt everything, but just grab it all, and one day maybe your grandchildren will be able to decrypt it, and then we can find out just what it was that was out there. There's a debate about when quantum computing will be able to crack the standard forms of encryption that protect everything from Bitcoin to your bank account. Some people think it's only a couple of years away. Others, notably the researchers at ARK Invest, say it won't arrive until 2044 at the earliest. That's not what they told us way back at the beginning. They said it won't be for, you know, hundreds of centuries at the very least. Anyway, hackers are not waiting for either of those dates. Instead, they're downloading whatever databases they can get their hands on, even if they cannot open them, and saving them for when commercial quantum computing makes it possible to decode the continents. You know what else? Doing that allows you to be backing up these databases in encrypted form, obviously, but, you know, it's a valuable service for the inevitable day that one of these companies just loses everything and doesn't have any backups. Well, here you are. You've got everything on your local computer system. Go ahead, Alex.
I think this is something we should talk further about on overtime because it deserves a lot of consideration. But think about this. This is the terrifying aspect of this kind of store now, decrypt later type of attack. most of the laws across this entire country with respect to data breaches, and most laws across the world, really, only require you to report a data breach if the data is actually breached. There is an assumption built into the laws that you don't have to report a breach if the data that was stolen was encrypted. So if the threat actors have been storing all of this data that has been stolen and all of these companies have not reported it because there was no obligation to report it to attorneys generals, information commissioners, etc., all of that data that belongs to all of these companies about these individuals, about trade secrets, about intellectual property, things under development, financial forecasting, all these types of, all this proprietary information, if quantum computing becomes available, well, that would be like a very simple can opener to pry open all of that data that's just been sitting there. And if that happens, things are going to get messy.
So you're saying that if there is an encrypted database out there and somebody accesses it, downloads it, whatever, that does not have to be revealed because they haven't actually accessed the data. They've simply copied the meaningless gibberish that...
exactly.
Wow. So if you have an encrypted file out there somewhere being stored by a company, you can assume it's been compromised and nobody's going to tell you about it. Wow. That's scary. That's scary, but also kind of funny. Hey, before we leave, we're heading to overtime now. As we mentioned, that is on YouTube, channel 2600. You can call us there. You can basically interact in various ways or just hear our voices for a little bit longer. We had a letter. The overtime on July 15th was exceptionally positive and enjoyable. Every caller, except one, seemed to be in a good mood, and the discussion was fun to listen to. It's nice to hear some happy chatter for a change, even though serious subjects are important. Signed, Lob. Well, Lob, thank you very much for that nice letter, and it's very true. We do need to talk about the serious issues, but also have fun at the same time. Let's not forget that. So join us on Overtime, or write to us, oth@2600.com. And don't forget to join us next week, 7 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM, 7 p.m. on Wednesday. And in the meantime, please, won't you support WBAI? Give to WBAI.org. And what's that 833 number once more? Guys?
We're looking.
That is 833-WBAI-NYC. That is 833-922-4692.
Okay. We'll see you next time. Good night. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.